one of the biggest aspects of the 20th century that kind of really takes away from what Jason was talking about last week, and adds to it in certain ways, is the onset of the L word, leisure. 20th century is one of those periods where, and who knows, we might look back thinking, how could they ever have had that much leisure time? And actually sort of existed. But it was nevertheless one of those key areas in human existence, certainly in Western culture, where leisure time started increasing. And in terms of actually making a living and working through that, people did have more time to engage possibly in the public sphere and areas relating to recreation and leisure and aspects relating to those things. Society was becoming transformed by the growth of both urban centres and industrialisation. And the media, who were gradually beginning to sort of open up a whole range of opportunities, etc., were trying not only to keep up with society's trends, but also to remain commercial and to tap into people's needs for innovation, information, and recreation. And of the expanding leisure facilities, one of the most important was that of the cinema. The cinema is something which effectively is still with us in its wonderful sort of experience now, going to the cinema, going to the multi-screen, seeing a movie and so on. But when it started, it was very much a case of moving pictures, things which actually came to life in front of your eyes, black and white, colour, sound and so on. And as the cinema actually grew in popularity, journalists started to look for ways to create a presence, just as they also did in radio broadcasting, although I'll talk about that in a couple of weeks' time. The newsreel was one of the areas that we're going to look at in the first part of this session before we talk about documentaries that relates to mass audience. It's where we come up with that term mass media. You have a mass audience of people who are actually going to see this, to see the movies of their choice, but also to be informed with respect to the news. Now, by the end, by the time of the First World War, it was estimated that actually over half of the British population went to the cinema once a week. Okay, it was a standard way forward. So 1917 figures, just before the end, 100 years ago, if you were actually at home, you weren't at war, etc., the likelihood would be that you'd be off to the cinema. It was a cheap night out, but the quality of that experience tended to vary. Many early cinemas were actually little more than glorified parish halls. Films were also shown to the troops in France, and newsreel and propaganda films were all common by 1918. They were obviously silent, which had its own problems, and the makers would include images and captions to explain what the audience were actually seeing. In many ways, they were more like an illustrated moving newspaper than the kind of film that we would think of today. And the propaganda services that certainly are an intrinsic part, certainly, of reporting in terms of war, were actually overhauled to create the Ministry of Information in 1918. And one of the key things that the government insisted upon for the Ministry of Information was that there was a news division and a cinema division involved with that. Now, the ministry aimed primarily to harness the cinema for propaganda purposes. They drew heavily on war reporters and produced full-length silent documentaries such as the battle scenes that showed major engagement on the Western Front. Clearly, those were often tidied up for public consumption, and we didn't see any of the shocking images that came out in the 1960s from Vietnam, for instance. And I'll return to how television sort of impacted in terms of the newsreel in a few moments. In general, most of the newsreels were concerned with showing British successes or indeed ignoring any other setbacks that were taking place in the war. And the ministry carried the responsibility for providing the British public with news of the war. It also made a large number of anti-German cartoons and a whole range of other films which promoted war savings or ways in which ordinary people could help to boost the economy. And these propaganda trailers were distributed through commercial newsreel networks, again reaching mass audiences. Now, in the period between the First World War and the Second World War, the interwar period, we saw an increase in terms of the quality of the experience. Gone were the days where people would gather in a room like this, in a parish hall and so on, and you actually started coming into the whole notion of the picture palace, this image, as they of the Westgate Cinema in Newcastle-upon-Tyne in 1932. They would include lots of additional added bonus factors. Sound was coming in. It was becoming very much a dream factory. So the whole notion of going out to the cinema and seeing Eric Hammersmith, the big screen, large auditoria, range of other elements that are coming through there, was very much part of this growth in terms of the medium of the cinema. Sound emerged in 1930, and by 1932 it was pretty standard for all films to actually have sound inputs. Newsreel would actually cover material that also wasn't just pictorial. They were using music, they were using stock footage, they were creating a far more entertaining montage. Again, I put links on Blackboard to the Pathé newsreels across a whole range of time slots, and you can see the styles and the approaches that's taken build up that whole sense of cinematic televisual literacy that arguably is still used today when you're producing documentaries, footage, video clips, and so on. Even on YouTube, dare I say it. By 1939, there were 5,000 cinemas in Britain. Some of the new purpose-built super cinemas could actually seat up to 4,000 people. And around 20 million tickets were being sold each week. Now, just to put this into context, in the mid-1930s, a cinema ticket would probably cost about sixpence, or 2.5p. Bless you. That was the equivalent to the price of a pint of beer. So it was affordable mass entertainment. Survey of Liverpool in 1937 found that 40% of Liverpudlians went to the cinema once a week, and another 25% actually went twice a week. And in York, it was found that half the population went to the cinema each week, which calculated out at around about 45,000 people each week. In other words, cinema was big business. And you might well go to see the favourite movies that you wanted to see, the gangster movies, the romance movies, the Busby Berkeley musicals, the escapism and so on. But it was a whole experience. It wasn't just see a couple of ads, watch the movie and then end. There was usually a main feature, a B feature, a secondary rate sort of thing, and then there were the newsreels as well. There were things like special penny pictures. There were Saturday morning matinees. They were targeting the people who are also least likely to read newspapers. In other words, the lower working class. People who effectively actually didn't really want to bother with all these words and things, but they did like the moving image, they liked the escapism that was provided by that. There's a lot of research which is still going on in terms of the audiences and the people who actually work through the process, but this particular term, which actually demonstrates how we get the term blockbuster today. Blockbuster, which we now see as a movie that actually is breaking all records and so on, originated from America, obviously it's demonstrated here in Newcastle, is where the movie was so popular people would literally queue around the block to actually get tickets for it, hence the term blockbuster. So what were some of the constraints that actually impacted in terms of newsreels and elements within that whole system? And this mini-industry of entertainment that people would actually work through that, whether you're a member of the cinema staff, or indeed whether you're part of the production team, etc. Well, first of all, it was actually quite expensive to produce. Okay, unlike a newspaper, film costs were quite expensive. And so what you got with newsreels by the main companies who were actually seen there, and there were five main companies who distributed newsreels, the names are up there, Gaumont, British, Movietone, Pathé, Paramount and Universal. They would primarily produce around about 520 newsreels per year. Okay, so pretty much 10 a week. There would be some weekend editions, there'd be some special editions. Many of the owners, though, actually saw themselves as producing newspapers, but as a film. So newspapers via film. And as I mentioned, there are around about 2 million feet of archive material that's actually around. Now, what we see when we look at the newsreels are things which effectively tell us what the public were told about events and personalities of the day. Things such as dumbing down of events, things such as royal news, etc., were all changed and adjusted to make them palatable. The editors of the newsreel production companies were actually quite nervous. They didn't want to offend. They never wanted to actually push any boundaries. They didn't want to change anything. They didn't want to actually fall foul of legal censorship laws. So to a large extent, they self-censored. And the makers of the newsreels still felt that morale boosting was part of their role. Certainly in Britain, it was a case of, it's a depression, so what? Be cheerful, keep the stiff upper lip going, work your way through the whole process. It's a world war again, let's keep going. However dark and depressing the years between the wars were, and indeed during the wars, one thing is certain, that newsreels consistently tried to promote the British spirit, whatever that is constructed as being. In other words, Britain would pull through as a country, and there's a hearty, upbeat tone that permeates the newsreels of the period. Usually with a voice which is male, often, received pronunciation, and very much positive in terms of onwards. Now that attracted criticism from a large number of other filmmakers, who felt that the British public should be allowed to see what was really happening in the world, and actually make up their own minds. And we'll see when I talk about documentaries in the second part of this, how that relates. In other words, film images should speak for themselves without a feel-good factor which consistently crept into content and commentary. Now, as we said, consider the audience. Always important when you're looking at any kind of analysis from media form, etc. By 1939, half of the population is attending the cinema. And they're also using the cinema as a primary source of news. Which half of the population? Well, the highest proportion of cinemas were in the industrial north. And as we've said, the programming was predominantly aimed at the working class. Lower income groups wouldn't go most often, and the upper classes would not be that keen to go to the cinema. They'd go to the theatre, they'd go to the opera, various other sort of aspects, not necessarily the cinema. Cinemas themselves were owned by competing individuals and chains. Their aims were entirely commercial. They were likely to put on what the customer wanted rather than to try to influence or indeed educate. They certainly weren't interested in accuracy or balance in news reporting as much as in scoops and in speed. The pictures needed to be there to back up the voice, and actually it didn't really matter if it wasn't the right picture or the useful picture or the wrong picture. And again, as well as news, as well as sporting events, parades, speeches and ship launchings, you had a range of things which were chosen primarily not to offend and also not necessarily to be time-locked in terms of what is being seen to happen, because these cinema newsreels are being circulated from one cinema to the next. They've got to have a certain amount of built-in repeat viewing and so on. The managers of the cinemas wanted entertainment, as I mentioned. They didn't want to have any upset patrons, and they certainly really didn't want even anything such as music in the background that could actually offend. So the result ultimately was a very safe editorial solution to go after the ordinary and to avoid anything that could be remotely deemed as sensational. Accordingly, the editors self-censoring. And it's probably fair to say that actually as editors, they took their responsibilities very seriously. They had a captive audience. Once the film starts in the cinema, you have an option of either leaving, walking out, or sticking through it. You stick through it, you're part of that audience, unless, of course, you go to sleep. It was generally accepted as well that film reports had more impact on audiences than newspaper reports. And so, particularly in times of war, in times of depression, they really didn't want to kind of impact on that dream factory nature of the cinema. Editors would meet regularly to decide on how to handle any touchy subjects. Usually, they'd decide not to cover them at all. One of the classic examples of this, of course, was the abdication of Edward VIII in 1936, and the decision was made simply not to report it. Inconceivable that you could actually see that happening today. Just a major story, abdication of the monarch, We just won't mention it. Hope it goes away. Also, throughout the 1930s, hunger marches, general strikes, all of these issues that are taking part and affecting British life, doesn't get a mention. Or if it does get a mention, it's very much seen from a kind of very positive view as far as possible. It was very much fear of the introduction of censorship or of offending the audience that led to this uncontroversial content. They weren't viewpoints, they were mere statements of fact. There certainly was never to be any criticism of the government, implied or indeed made explicit in terms of what the viewer and the audience were faced with. And it's fair to say that that approach and the generally cheerful tone that they actually took served them pretty well through the Second World War and into the 50s, when they were seen pretty much as widely hitting the right note. What did then the average man and woman and family want to actually see and hear? Well, as we said, the newsreel did actually serve the audience who wanted to actually see them. This is actually taken from the 60s, and we see there the sort of main headlines, Dad's Army, Kells, Scrooge, so first multiplex that's sort of developing there. You want a general audience, a line that comes through with what we're seeing and so on. And for an audience who wanted to primarily hang on to what they perceived as the decencies of life, the kind of notion of what it meant to be British, people who would effectively sort of relate to still maintaining the way of life that they'd grown up with and so on, actually it was perfectly understandable they didn't want to be offended. You needed to have a strictly policed vision of what it meant to be British in the 1930s, in the 1940s, and the 1950s. So you didn't attack the social and political systems, and the nation as a whole was assumed to be strong and fair, the Commonwealth was secure, the class system was natural and good, and any other viewpoints were simply excluded. Again, thinking of the time, thinking of situations, thinking of what we're actually seeing within the newsreels, perfectly acceptable. It's a wonderful way of travelling through time. Look at some of the films that were being made. Look at David Lean's Brief Encounter. See the kind of mannered comedies that are actually developed there. Look at the ways in which people are changing in the sense of what it meant to be British. Very powerful image. We're really talking here about the construction of a national identity that doesn't just serve people within the country, but it's also projected globally in terms of that's what it means to be British. Exactly. Sorted out. Now, to the 21st century audience, the reports that we see on newsreels are often seen as patronising. They often can be ill-informed. As I mentioned, they're delivered in a clipped form of received English. It's called Oxford English or BBC English. That was the voice of news reporting, and so dialects effectively didn't serve to pay any part unless those dialects were used as a form of amusement. Do you want to go and get some coffee, some water? Are you okay? I've never had any dying lecturers yet, but there's always the possibility. Okay. So, good. Right. By the beginning of the Second World War, however, there were the beginnings of specialist news theatres that were developing. Because there was a concern, certainly amongst academics and producers that were there, that somehow there needed to be something which actually started talking about what all this news actually meant. I've already said that there's a big difference in terms of the images that we see there. There's a slide that's taken from the contents of Pathé News in 1962, where they lead with King Hussein leading with the RAF. There's good cheer all round with Trafalgar Square, so the Christmas piece. Features are still there, but scroll back in time, dial back a little bit further, and there's a concern with so many images being put forward. How did these things actually be consumed? What impact was it having? A bit like the analysis that happens these days, where you say if you spend too much time on Facebook, effectively it can cause major depression. Because everybody else is having a good time, you're not having a good time, oh, it's a disaster. So, in addition to setting up specialised news theatres, there's also a way of actually determining discussion groups, finding out what's being said, what's being talked about, why are things being addressed and so on. And this is where we see a bit of a blending, a mixture between newsreel makers, newsreel audiences, and the whole notion of the documentary movement and so on. Nevertheless, even though we had, in terms of ownership, the Daily Telegraph owner, Camrose, had extensive shares in Gaumont British. Rothermere of the Daily Mail actually looked at, he was joint owner of British Movie Tone News. And Beaverbrook from the Express was connected to British Lion Films, so there was cross-media ownership. Newsreels never quite moved into an area where they would be dealing with what we now refer to as hard news and news which was effectively open to debate and so on. And as television took over in the 1950s, all of those positive feel-good elements, the stories that people would go to the cinema to actually see, effectively were covered by television audiences into the 1960s. Why did it last until the 1960s? Why didn't it simply wrap up the newsreel when the television first came into mass production and mass ownership in the 1950s? Well, quite simply, the C word, colour. It wasn't really until colour television started permeating the domestic market that actually then the last remaining reason for actually going and seeing the news in cinemas was actually sort of taken to one side, and they said, actually, maybe the newsreel has effectively had its day. And so the newsreel ends. But where the newsreel actually ends, something else that actually opens up is even more exciting and relevant and pertinent to where we are today in terms of the documentary. The documentary film movement primarily is a term which we use to refer to a group of filmmakers and a body of film that appears primarily from the 1920s to the early 1950s. Although it's quite clear that as a form in itself, as a generic form, whether it's Louis Theroux, whether it's David Attenborough, whether it's any of the other prolific documentary channels that are actually developed out there, the documentary still exists in the similar form today. Okay, so it's still very much there. It hasn't kind of simply migrated onto YouTube videos with furry cats and so on. And the gentleman that I've actually put up there is regarded very much as the father of the modern British documentary film movement. Name constantly associated with respect to British documentaries, John Grierson. So, when did this start? Well, it started with the first feature-length documentary made by Robert Flaherty in 1922, and it was a feature-length documentary entitled Nanook of the North. It was a documentary that was designed to show the audience Eskimo life in the northern reaches of Canada. And as I mentioned, it was made by Robert Flaherty. He's actually the young man just there with his family. Little quote from Robert Flaherty, which is worth considering. Even in my youth, I was always exploring new country. My father was a mining engineer, and in manner of speaking, we were a nomad family. We moved from one gold mining camp to another in various parts of Canada. I was then about 12 years of age. I learnt to track and hunt rabbits from the Indians, and I had an Indian dog team and toboggan. It was frontier country where the Indians were much more primitive than they are now. This was a young man who grew up in really a kind of state of romance for a wonderful life, which he saw disappearing. He saw with the advent of technology and the expansion of the West and the frontiers, partly brought about by settlers, both in North America, the United States of America, and in Canada, was changing. And Flaherty himself actually always saw himself as an idealist, somebody who could actually come up with the whole concept of the noble savage. And he wanted to record that. He wanted to record it in a way in which future generations, 100 years from when he was actually developing the thing, more, would still actually look back and see this notion of the idea of the nobility of man living traditional life close to nature. The fact that the film was actually paid for and financed by a French company who dealt in fur trapping, by the by. It's the first, again, example in terms of motion pictures of saying, well, okay, how are we going to get this story across? How are we going to start developing this? And certainly if you're looking at the images that he's going to use, that's wonderful. Until you realise that many of those images were actually artificially constructed in the studio. And then you start coming to the question of, well, how real is real? Do you develop, as Bill Nichols says, the notion of documentary being a world constructed for a purpose? Perfectly acceptable, as long as you're quite explicit about how that purpose develops and works through. Robert Flaherty, clearly a leader in his field in terms of developing that area, and somebody who in his own way influenced the aforementioned John Grierson, who's there seen on the right-hand side, at the kind of height of his career, really, where he's had some of his movies that he's connected with in the background there. John Grierson is probably the most pivotal person when it comes to the history of documentary in the United Kingdom that we can come to. He's a kind of touchstone when it comes to applying some of Flaherty's development and putting them into practice with respect to what we're seeing, how we're seeing this construction of life and so on. What was his background? Always useful to start finding out, as we, you know, in seminars we talked about what was the background of some of our folk that Jason was introducing last week, and the whole notion of the public sphere and Habermas and so on. Well, unlike Flaherty, Grierson had a slightly more interesting background, although nevertheless fairly privileged. He was born in 1898 in Scotland, and he was a university student. So clearly he had a certain amount of ability and developed and went off to higher education. He was a minesweeper in the First World War. And what did I say? Served aboard a minesweeper in terms of areas for that. And after the First World War, he went off to the United States to study. What did he study? He studied psychology. He studied the psychology of public opinion, and he also studied what was essentially propaganda. Ways in which you can influence people. Now, this is at a time where culturally, in the United States and Britain, there's generally a sort of feeling that we need to be able to fix society. How can we fix society? Well, we can fix society in the same way that we fixed a lot of problems, like disease, by cleaning our water, by applying science, by showing how things can improve and so on. This kind of goes through both the Wall Street crash, the Great Depression that followed that, the warfares and so on. What's the best way around this? How can we avoid these things happening? So in many ways, echoing some of the things that Habermas was trying to wrestle with in terms of this cannot happen again. How did this happen? Why did it happen? How do we actually change things around from preventing it happening? And what Grierson is actually really driven by is idealism. Actually, it's not too much of a jump from what Grierson was talking about in terms of his idealism and the radical press of the 19th century, which we'll talk about again latterly in the module. Clearly, ways in which you can actually develop the narrative, develop the tale, to actually talk about a background of severe social crises. Poverty, recession. Okay, Britain still had an empire in the 1920s. It was still financially well off. We were technically sort of working through a variety of other areas. But, that's important, but there was a large amount of poverty and recession in the country. There was huge migration from Scotland and from Ireland to cities. The shift from a rural environment to an urban environment was shifting very much to the fore. Between the 1870s and 1930s, actually Britain boasted the worst housing conditions in Europe. And we had the three classics. We had disease, we had alcoholism, and we had illegitimacy. The expenditure on poor people in the country was by far the lowest across the European continent. So actually, we might have a wonderful ship that was sailing on the one hand, but underneath, quite a lot of poverty. There was class conflict. There was a perception that unbridled capitalism, the gross misuse of resources to amass huge private fortunes, was resulting in the exploitation of workers, and the majority were subject to huge deprivation. And yet, no one actually protested. Why? We'd already seen through mass media that you'd had a revolution in Russia, which had kind of impacted precisely because of these situations and problems. Well, actually, maybe I can suggest some of the founding reasons in terms of why people didn't protest. The Labour movement at the time, not the government, the Labour movement, was dominated primarily by respectable, moderately skilled workers who opposed radicalism. There was still very much a sense of deference that actually you should pay, you know, due homage to the factory workers and officers and so on, because they were very important. The Scottish Labour movement was actually dominated by the pro-capitalist Liberal Party. And also unskilled workers, certainly in Scotland, were impoverished, they were disorganised, and they were fragmented. And perhaps even more importantly, perhaps borrowing from an American perspective here, there was an ideology very much prevalent that everybody should be free to pursue individual happiness, and the free market should occur without any state intervention, and anybody who actually found themselves living in conditions that weren't actually the best, or they were poverty, etc., actually it's what they deserved. Everybody settled towards their own natural level. Grierson clearly didn't accept that. He didn't accept it as a way forward, and he didn't necessarily want to actually sort of call to arms as well. So this is one of the reasons why Between the Wars, the documentary film movement, actually became associated with the political left. Why? Because it actually gave some sort of voice to the underrepresented working class, whether that was by intention or whether it was just a reaction to the film industry, but it certainly wasn't a dream factory, but it was a representation of reality. And it's also using what we now refer to as nudge theory to begin to use public relations and elements within that to get people to change their behaviour and change their activities. The documentary film movement became very much associated under John Grierson in two consecutive government film units. The Empire Marketing Board, interesting because obviously we still had a British Empire then, so it was the Empire Marketing Board, that ran between 1927 to 1933. And then from 1933 to 1939, you can see that the General Post Office finally wrapped up by the Crown Film Unit, which took us up to 1952. Why eat more fish? It's cheap, it's hot, and it's wholesome. It was a way of actually improving nutrition by effectively improving the fast food package and saying this is worthwhile focusing on and so on. Part of the documentary movement was really summed up in three words: celebrate the ordinary. And if there's one thing I'd like you to take away from the session today, consider that. Celebrate the ordinary. Grierson, as I mentioned, was an idealist. He very much wanted to ensure that he campaigned for political reform, and that through film, because mass audiences were going to see the film, or hopefully would go and see the film, you would actually have a way to reflect the writing, the speeches, the lectures, all of which are part of a whole set of attitudes which fundamentally were looking to create a better society. Yes, Grierson was an idealist. He emerged from a relatively comfortable middle-class family. He was the son of a teacher. He was well-read. He was well-behaved. He wasn't a revolutionary, but he did want to nudge change and work into that, and believed quite categorically that the state or the government should intervene where appropriate for the greater good. It should prevent individuals threatening the community with selfish desires, and each individual should be allowed to develop to their full potential. They should have a social duty. They should effectively have a harmony and a unity based on the general good of all. You might say that was somewhat naive. You might say that these were ideas he might have got from his university courses, whether in Britain or indeed in America, and it actually didn't really fit with experience or reality. But at least it was a start, and a start of actually raising issues. And the technology of the time offered a medium of communication which could connect from the state, and corporations to the ordinary people. The aims were also to advance social cohesion. So they were both educational and social. Again, another Grierson quote. I have no great interest in films as such. I look on cinema as a pulpit and use it as a propagandist. So it's quite explicit there. He's not making The Wizard of Oz, or he's not making Ben-Hur, or The Dream Factory. He's looking very much at getting things together. He saw film as a collaborative exercise, which was technically innovative, and he would actually use a broad range of elements to work through that. Most of his films, in fact, the vast majority, were all designed to show people working together for the social good. Now, this is where we get a complete contrast between Grierson and his team, and his documentarians, which we'll look at in a few moments, and the newsreel makers and the newsreel manufacturers. Grierson looked upon the newsreel folk as purveyors of cheap, shoddy news, news that effectively was being dumbed down. It was cheerful rubbish that didn't offend or worry anyone. It was a situation in which newsreels were determined to make people think that the way that they wanted them to think, and then their version of social good might be, again, elitist, out of touch, and so on. But it is interesting, if you get a chance again, they're all online, praise be to the web and so on, have a look at things like Drifters and look at the structure in which they're developed. Now, Drifters was a 1924 production, so even just a couple of years after we'd seen Nanook of the North, and it was a montage, a collection of the Scottish herring industry. A couple of key things here that are worth discussing in seminars afterwards. Number one, we are led to believe that in terms of the fishing industry, it's as it happened. No. The boat was actually set in a studio. The fish that we actually see were actually shot in an aquarium in Plymouth. You can actually see in some ways the lighting behind the whole system. So again, there are big questions that come through in terms of that. There, yes, one or two external shots, but again, technology being grown there. We don't have the sort of portability of cameras that we have today, although arguably David Attenborough was accused of changing things around recently with respect to his own sort of productions. Does it matter if the ends justify the means? Again, it's a debating sort of point. There's the fish. You can probably just about, if you again look at it, you can see all shot behind an aquarium. Not in Scotland, not in the North Sea, but in Plymouth. I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's wrong, but again, it's interesting as it's being purported as being a version of the truth. Alberto Cavalcanti, another co-worker with respect to Grierson, he studied architecture in France, and he became involved in avant-garde filmmaking. He actually worked with Grierson throughout the 1930s, and played a significant role in some of his best films. What Cavalcanti did was he actually understood film techniques. You also get some early sound effects emerging in some of his areas, including things like Fairy of the Foam. Cavalcanti is basically seen there on the left, actually giving some instruction to somebody we believe is a genuine worker. Again, it's a notion of, are they actors? Are they developing that? Are they putting words into people's mouths and so on? Another one that comes through, Humphrey Jennings. Now, Humphrey Jennings, really at the heart of the Second World War, was charged, certainly by the government, with producing material which would be uplifting. And here we see him actually coaching people in a pub to actually demonstrate how to actually work through this whole process, how to really develop what's a series called Listen to Britain. Now, this is not going out in British cinemas. This is going out in American cinemas. This is part of an ongoing way between 1939 through to 1942 of saying to America, we need your help. Look at us Brits, we're doing so well, we're battling through, we're really plucky, but we can't continue ever onwards. It's interesting that when it came to actually air raids, because Jennings was never able to obviously get his film crew to an actual air raid to actually shoot whilst it's actually happening, he would actually set buildings alight and film them as though they were the aftermath of air raids, etc. After the war, of course, we move into Basil Wright, The Song of Ceylon. This is a tale about modernity, and also the impact of modernity and industry on modern ways of life. You could almost say that what Basil Wright is doing in this one is harking back 30 years to Robert Flaherty and the Nuke of the North, this staggering backwards into the future, looking longingly into the past. So where then is the difference in terms of these documentaries and that social realism I was talking about a bit earlier? But it's still there. Because what Grierson again is developing, together with Jennings, together with Cavalcanti and so on, is this notion of people speaking directly to camera. Something which even now is something which is seen as, when you're talking directly to camera, you're either a newsreader or you're possibly a politician doing party political broadcasts. If you have that eye-to-eye, one-to-one concept, somehow generally it seems making what you're saying just that little bit more important. And if you're talking about housing problems, allowing working-class people to talk directly to you, the viewer, about dwelling in a slum, living in a slum, speaking directly to the camera, you're certainly going to be arguably more impactful than simply having somebody talking about it and just done as a voiceover. It's personalising the whole story. It's personalising what we actually see and developing from that aspect. And celebrating the ordinary. Again, key things that are coming through within that. Night Train, masterpiece in celebrating the Royal Mail. Travelling across the lands, it's used very much with a W.H. Auden poem under the line as a bedrock. This is the night train crossing the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order, letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop on the corner and the girl next door. So it's kind of tapping into certain entertainment scenarios, but it is, again, a reality constructed for a purpose. It's demonstrating key things that we're looking through. Now, it's arguable in terms of what we've looked at today that you've looked primarily at public service filmmaking. We've looked at social documents, we've looked at a whole variety of other things. However, on the other side, you could say, hang on a minute here, isn't Grierson and the whole documentary movement actually arguing for a public relations elite? Aren't they talking about social propaganda? Aren't they even referring to newspaper writers and editors like W.T. Stead in the 19th century, who are basically trying to create attitudes rather than to simply reflect those attitudes? In other words, big question, worth writing down and noting for next week or whatever, are films representing reality or are they trying to create it? Do films represent reality or do they try to create it? And is documentary always going to be intrinsically artificial, recreated, because people are aware of the cinema? In other words, it's manufactured. As we've said, British documentary films had a political dimension, and that's been stressed certainly by its time and the war and so on. Returning briefly to Humphrey Jennings in London Can Take It, the mail train from the Yellow Night Crossing. If you can't actually be there because you don't have the time or energy to work that, and also it can be a health and safety issue, create your own version of what you're seeing. It's also quite fascinating, if you look at the Picture Posts, and we're really fortunate in Lincoln to actually have a full archive of genuine, a full run of the Picture Posts originals over in the library, which you can actually go and see at any time, you see an awful lot of the picture images that are actually there, which are almost stills from the documentary filmmakers. Again, it's that reincarnation of real life and so on. And the Picture Posts between the 1930s and 1950s, or Life magazine in the United States, were hugely popular magazines. So you're seeing this cross-reference, cross-media reference between the filmic image, the documentary image, and indeed the cinematic, the printed image and so on. As the Picture Posts, again, snapshots of reality and areas that relating to the whole system. Celebrating the ordinary. So again, there's that tendency that we're focusing on the nobility and richness of ordinary life. That actually we're celebrating the lives of workers on whom society depends. You're reinforcing social cohesion. Sum it all up there. Stiff upper lip, my reply to Goebbels in the 1939 edition. Two chaps here, you know, obviously one presumably with his bowler hat, suggesting he has a sort of city sort of background there, one with flat cap and chips from that sort of perspective. Is it constructed? Is it a snapshot of reality? Open for discussion. And probably one of my favourites. Is that an R factor? 1939, world's on the brink of World War, but we've still got time for a nice furry animal. So, again, if you're looking at any social realism, this is a wonderful period where you can actually work that out. And probably, rather like the newsreels, certain elements of documentary kind of were superseded by television as well. Certainly the sort of the newspapers like Picture Post, etc., were doing that. But for a brief period, certainly in the middle part of the 20th century, we did have a range of sort of elements that came through. We did have this notion of celebrating ordinary life. You don't need a PlayStation, just a tyre will give you loads and loads of fun times to actually be had. And you also get a sort of shot from the Windrush, the notion of what's happening, how do we relate to changes in society? Because certainly coming from the 1950s and the post-empire world, the modern world, the area from that perspective, you see a range of other elements coming to the fore. Leading, actually, up to another series, which you can also access on YouTube, etc., the public information films, the lines that work through that. This whole idea that film is ultimately a good way for the government to communicate with the public for the public good. Coughs and sneezes spread diseases, right the way through to climate change. Central Office of Information produced a wide range of information campaigns designed to inform the public on a huge range of issues which affected their daily lives, such as health, welfare, education, and rights. Again, the question to maybe conclude the session with today and to lead into Jason's return next week is quite simply, for both documentary and newsreel makers, were the filmmakers trying to alter behaviour? And if they were, should they have been trying to alter behaviour? And if that's the case, how much success did they actually have in altering behaviour? Thanks for your time, and I'll see you all next week.